Chapter 19. This is going to be big. Sandrine. Danica O'Carroll was back home in Ireland, back inside the ring, in the middle of June 2021. He was there to visit his family and friends, but the trip could hardly be counted as vacation. Danica spent much of his time in Birr at his parents' kitchen table, his laptops and notebooks splayed out in front of him, bent to his work. The scene in their kitchen may have given Danica's parents reason for pause, given his complicated history in the cyber world. Danica could not confide in his parents exactly what kind of work he was doing. But they did know this much. When their son spent this much time on his computer, wrapped up in secret projects, it had not always resulted in happy outcomes. "Is this all legit?" his father asked him at one point in the visit. Danica had little choice but to stick to his private business, whatever his parents' concern. The Pegasus project was gaining momentum every day, as if the entire 80-person team was just starting to accelerate toward a long, final kick to the finish line. I felt it in Paris, and no doubt Danica felt it too. He represented an entire half of the project's crucial forensics team, and the journalists working on Pegasus were piling more on his shoulders every day. One of the imperatives we had set for ourselves involved a numbers game. We had already verified the identities of close to 1,000 of the 50,000 selections in the data. The verifications included about 150 journalists, and our goal was to get that number up to 200 before publication. The deadline we had set for that task was July 6th, just 3 weeks away. We were also working hard to confirm as many people as possible who had been victimized by Pegasus attacks or actual Pegasus infections, which meant a steady flow of backup files from mobile phones or the physical phones themselves was washing into the security lab. The daughter of the hero of Hotel Rwanda, Karine Kanimba, had provided backup files from her two iPhones a week earlier, for instance. Hannes Munsinger from Süddeutsche Zeitung had approached Karine after the German newspaper had found the mobile phone number of her father's attorney in the data. Because Karine was a vocal spokesperson defending her father and a vocal critic of the Rwandan regime, Hannes believed she might also be a Pegasus target. There was no clear evidence of Pegasus infection on either iPhone, but enough suspicious activity that we asked her if she would send the phones to Berlin for a jailbreak analysis. Stephanie Kirchgassner from The Guardian had persuaded a second exiled human rights defender from Rwanda to allow Claudio and Danica to run forensics on his cell phone logs. Pegasus Project reporters were approaching people in the data from all over the world. Siddharth and his team from The Wire had found four possible victims in India willing to submit their phones to forensics. A human rights lawyer, a human rights defender, a labor union official, and a journalist. Phineas found two more journalists from India who agreed to the forensics and to go public if the Pegasus targeting was confirmed. A third said, "No, thank you," telling Phineas that he was in the middle of very sensitive reporting and wasn't willing to risk compromising it. The wife of a Moroccan political dissident who was serving a 30-year prison sentence said yes to the forensics. Frederick Obermeyer, Bastian Obermeyer, and Szabó Csepanyi all had new candidates for analysis in Hungary. A reporter from Süddeutsche Zeitung thought she had a chance to get the iPhone of a young Azeri dissident who had drowned in Istanbul just a month earlier. His number was selected back in 2019. Not long after Khadija Ismailova was first targeted. The most urgent forensics at that moment in mid-June revolved around the Jamal Khashoggi case. Traces of evidence in the Android phone belonging to Khashoggi's wife, Hanan, suggested she had been targeted by Pegasus spyware before his murder, but did not prove a successful infection. So Dana Priest of the Washington Post was flying to Istanbul with Arthur Bouvart from Forbidden Stories on June 15th to meet with Khashoggi's closest contacts in Turkey, including his fiancée, Hatice Cengiz, who had been waiting outside the consulate in Istanbul at the time of his murder. Hatice was also in our data. If things went as planned, Claudio and Danica would be analyzing her mobile phone any day. On top of the ongoing requests for forensic analyses, the two cybersecurity researchers were just beginning to pull together a report detailing their findings to present to NSO before publication. We had an obligation as journalists to give the company a chance to comment on, dispute, or correct any of the facts we deemed solid enough to publish. Amnesty International and the Security Lab felt ethically bound to give NSO the opportunity to respond to specifics in the forensic findings as well. Claudio and Danica were also preparing the materials they would be releasing to the public at large when the Pegasus project went live on July 18th. The pair had decided to do something fairly unprecedented in the short annals of cyber surveillance research. They were going to be completely transparent. They weren't going to merely show their findings. They meant to show their work, in detail, to the world. There would be a comprehensive report on Security Lab methodology, including the design, development, and implementation of their forensic tool. Claudio and Danica were also preparing to report in detail the evidence they had found for each and every confirmed attack or infection, and to expose all the zero-click and zero-day exploits they had identified, as well as all the Pegasus-generated process names and fake accounts that NSO made available to its clients for delivery of the malicious spyware payload. The reports were still evolving because Claudio and Danica were gathering new evidence almost every day. On June 14th, while Danica was in Ireland and Dana Priest and Arthur Bouvard were heading out for their trip to Istanbul, Claudio was in his office in Berlin, jailbreaking one of Khadija Ismailova's cell phones. Miranda Petrucic had carried the phones to Germany for further analysis after her reunion with Khadija in Ankara. Claudio had one of Khadija's iPhones wired into his laptop that sunny, late spring morning while Miranda peered over his shoulder, trying to make sense of the impenetrable lines of code filling the screen, highlighted in different colors. "This is what it looks like, really," Claudio explained. "I mean, this is just the output of our tool. So essentially, we see processes that we know are connected to Pegasus. We'll see some iMessage accounts that are connected to the attacks. Is it new ones or the ones you've seen before in her backup files?" Miranda wanted to know. "I believe these are the ones we've seen before, but I'm going to have to basically later sit down and go through the ones I may not have seen," Claudio explained, pointing out different lines on the screen. It was all pretty standard fare. Lines of code he and Danica had observed dozens of times by now. "This might indicate what the entry point is," he said. And then suddenly, "What the fuck? That's weird. There are some new traces that we have not seen before. They might be indicative of some other exploits that we've not seen before." He told Miranda he needed a little extra time to do some more digging. Danica had a look as well, and the two partners agreed. This was something new, an exploit neither had ever seen before. NSO researchers had apparently found a vulnerability related to Apple Music sometime before the summer of 2020, because the Pegasus system used it as the entry point for delivery of malicious spyware payload to Khadija's iPhone as early as July 10th of that year. The evidence in Khadija's phone didn't allow Claudio and Danica to determine exactly where in the exploit chain Apple Music fit, whether it was the vehicle for the final delivery of the payload, or just an early stage in prying open a back door. But it pointed to an NSO-created domain Claudio and Danica had identified back in 2019. And the URL pattern used to download the payload showed another key link between the attacks on Mati Monjib's phone in 2019, Khadija's in 2020, and the Pegasus zero-click exploit chain being used in 2021. This late discovery meant a whole new section that Claudio and Danica would have to write into their forensic methodology report. Apple Music leveraged to deliver Pegasus in 2020. Dana Priest and Arthur Bouvard arrived in Istanbul the next day, June 15, 2021, and shuttled back and forth to Ankara over the next few days so they could meet with both Khashoggi's fiancée, Hatice Cengiz, and his good friend Yasin Aktay, a Turkish government official. Aktay was not only Khashoggi's emergency contact in Turkey, he was also a key aide and confidant to Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. When Dana explained to Aktay that he was in our data, he expressed no surprise. In the aftermath of Khashoggi's murder, he said, he had been told by agents from the Turkish Interior Ministry that his phone had been hacked. He didn't ask who had compromised his phone at the time, and he waved off Dana's request that he make that ask now. Aktay agreed to sit for an interview, but he refused to let us run forensics on his phone. His life and his professional dealings were an open book, he said, and he'd long ago changed to a new phone. Aktay did not appear to be a wary man by nature, but he was wary of the ruling families in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, for whom he had little good to say. Nobody had ever tried to assassinate him, he told Dana, but he wasn't taking any chances. He had a personal bodyguard and a big Mercedes with darkly tinted windows, maybe bulletproof. When he took Dana to the airport, Aktay's driver pushed the limo up to 120 miles per hour. It is very hard to have an assassination plan when you go fast, he said. Hatice Cengiz had been forced into her own tight security bubble after Jamal Khashoggi's killing. She was protected at all times by a security detail provided by the Turkish Interior Ministry, but rarely went out in public, even with her armed guards. Hatice did consent to meet with Dana and Arthur, and she did agree, after a lot of gentle cajoling by the two reporters, to let the security lab run the forensics on her iPhone. She seemed skeptical that the forensics would turn up anything because she had been told that the iPhone was a very secure device. Danica was sitting at the kitchen table at his boyhood home in Bur, right down the hall from the room where he learned his cyber skills, where he had pranked Rupert Murdoch 10 years earlier, and where the local police had first burst in to question him about his alleged cyber crimes. When the upload of Hatice's iPhone backup commenced in that third week of June. Claudio was outside on his balcony in Berlin, on the line with Dana, talking her through the process, and also on a separate line with Danica. When the files uploaded, the security lab forensic tool dug out the goods in no time. Claudio and Danica, separated by 2,000 kilometers, could both see it all at the same time. They knew exactly what they had found. There was the crash reporter file, and the BH process, and a data extraction, and another Pegasus-generated process name. Hatice's phone had no doubt been attacked and successfully compromised by Pegasus spyware. There was evidence of attack and/or infection on three separate days over a six-day span in early October 2018. The first attack was 4 days after MBS's Saudi thugs murdered Jamal Khashoggi. This was like a turning point, Claudio remembered of that moment. We had already found a lot of cases by then, but for me, it just clicked. Fuck, this is going to be big. It's not just a bunch of journalists in some country nobody ever heard of or nobody cares about. This will have impact. Because of the gravity of the story in which Hatice was involved, and because of the fact it had been repeated by NSO and Shalev ad nauseam that it was all bullshit. Danica had the same reaction. This is not overhyped, the Khashoggi thing, he remembers thinking. It is actually really real. This disproves all the lies NSO has been saying for years, that they didn't have anything to do with the murder. I remember standing up from my table and almost being like, "Oh, wow, we found the evidence." Things were happening so fast now that it was real work to keep track. There were around 80 journalists on the project, and we had separate investigations going in Europe, Asia, Africa, the Americas, and the Middle East. Nina Lacani of The Guardian was just back from Mexico. She hadn't had any more luck than Paloma locating Cecilio Pineda's phone. But Nina had filled out the story about Cecilio's final bits of work and the threats against him in the weeks before his still unsolved murder. Siddharth had met with a political opponent of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, Rahul Gandhi, who confirmed the reports that someone, and Gandhi made it sound like it might have been someone inside NSO, had warned him that he had been targeted. Christophe Clerics of Canuck in Belgium was going back to talk to Karine Kanimba to get her phones for another round of forensics. I spent hours at my flat with a reporter from Radio France, who was headed to Rwanda, trying to game out how she might approach known Pegasus targets there. This was no easy task. Rwanda was a dangerous place for a foreign journalist to work. She knew she would likely be watched and followed by government security services. Even after decades developing sources in the region, she had no one there she could absolutely trust to maintain the necessary secrecy. The Washington Post's Craig Timberg was getting good background material from cybersecurity specialists, who at least had some limited vision into the vulnerabilities in Apple's iMessage app. "Send unlimited texts, photos, videos, documents, and more," was how Apple marketed the app. This one service does it all program was a remarkable convenience for the user. But that convenience came with a cost few users understood. When iMessage was just an Apple version of SMS, it was pretty locked down, according to one cyber expert. But once the app allowed iPhones to download video and GIFs and games, it became significantly less secure. As Apple added more and more facets to iMessage, it created a larger attack surface. Martin Untersinger from Le Monde was able to add to Craig's reporting with a source who had spent some time on Apple's security team. "In the beginning, the iOS had few vulnerabilities, but the past few years have gotten worse," Martin offered the team as general background. The iPhone was likely the most secure mobile phone on the market, and Apple still had a colossal team playing defense, he explained. But that team had a lot coming at them, both in terms of outside researchers hunting flaws and coders accidentally creating them. "Developers introduce bugs when they code badly, when they start off with a complicated code base, or because they're pressed to work fast. Apple releases have accelerated in the last few years." Holger Stark was just back from Tel Aviv with sackfuls of very useful reporting, including confirmations of some key facts about NSO and its relations with the Israeli government and its intelligence services. National security reporter Shane Harris and another of his colleagues from The Washington Post had scheduled their own trip to Israel for early July. Amitai Ziv, meanwhile, was on his way to interview Udi Ansbacher about his questionable dealings in Mexico, which he knew a lot more about now with access to the leaked documents Carmen Aristegui had shared with the group. Amitai had just gotten a call from Shalev Julio's founding partner in NSO, Omri Lavi, who wanted to sit down for a coffee the last week of June. Amitai had just published a story in Haaretz on NSO's recent financial woes, so it was likely Omri was trying to do damage control on that front. But the invite still made me wonder for a second whether or not NSO was onto us. My nerves were already a little twitchy when Laurent came in on June 17th and showed me a disquieting message from Fabrice Arfi, our friend and colleague from Mediapart, who had helped convince Edwy Plenel to let us do the forensics on his phone back in April. Fabrice had sent Laurent a text saying that he had heard some loose talk around Paris about Edwy's Pegasus infection. Neither Fabrice nor Edwy were happy about it. Mediapart was doing its own reporting on cyber surveillance separate from our consortium, but they had made the collegial offer to hold their stories until after we published. Fabrice was worried that a story about Pegasus infections inside Mediapart would leak, and it would embarrass the respected site. Edwy was nervous, Fabrice was nervous, I was a bit concerned myself. We were still a month away from publication, and it was my job to make sure this investigation remained a close-held secret until we were ready to hit the go button. Christophe Clarix was determined to nail down the Karine Kanimba story for Canuck when he went to see her in Belgium on June 24, 2021. Christophe had been an enthusiastic partner on the Pegasus project, and he knew Karine was living in Belgium at the time. Her father, Paul Rusesabagina, had been kidnapped by Rwandan authorities a year earlier, was currently being tried on very questionable charges, and it looked like he was going to be railroaded into a sentence that ensured he would die in prison. Karine had left Rwanda as a young girl, shortly after surviving the genocide there. She had gone to college in the United States and worked in New York for part of her career. But she had been living in Belgium since her father's kidnapping. Karine carried two phones, one with a Belgian number and one with a U.S. number. Neither phone proved particularly cooperative. Christophe had already gone to see Karine three times in Belgium in the previous 3 weeks to facilitate the forensics on her two phones. But the analysis was still not completed to anyone's satisfaction. On the first visit, when Christophe tried to make a backup of one phone, the file was just too big. On the second visit, a key file went missing in the upload to the security lab. The plan for Christophe's fourth visit was to get a more complete backup of the Belgian phone for Claudio to analyze. Further complications arose that day. When Christophe tried to collect the diagnostic logs from Karine's phone, the process froze. Something Claudio had never seen before. I was like, well, that's strange, Claudio remembers. He suggested that Karine shut down the phone and restart it, which she did, and this time the log extraction worked without a hitch. It occurred to Claudio that day that maybe the phone was compromised with Pegasus at the very moment he had tried to extract the data, and the malware was blocking him. When he checked the diagnostic logs in the timeline, he found the Pegasus process executions he had seen over and over the previous few months. OTPGREFD, launch AFD, VRN underscore stats. There were records right up until the minute that I told her to shut the phone down. She was getting infected every few days, and we happened to be there. We thought we were on their tail when we had started finding cases a month old, Danica says. Then we started finding cases a week old. Then, with Karine, we found somebody whose phone was hacked at the very moment we were analyzing the phone. Okay, now we're really going head-to-head. They're targeting, and we're actively finding infections that are happening right now. We're really, really on their tail. By now, after almost 4 months of forensics, the increasing proximity to the attacks has paid off. As Claudio and Danica moved from looking at historical cases to active targeting and live infections, crimes in progress, you could call it, they had developed enough evidence on enough different mobile phones to be able to piece together the zero-day, zero-click iMessage exploit chain that Pegasus had been employing throughout 2021. Claudio and Danica called this sophisticated new attack Megalodon, a name in their Pegasus evidence file. Megalodon was also the name of the largest species of shark that ever lived, which was probably not lost on NSO exploit developers. The security lab forensic tool had first turned up evidence of Megalodon on the mobile phone of a French human rights lawyer back in March. And Claudio and Danica had seen it on other phones in April, May, and now at the end of June, in Karine's iPhone. The problem, of course, was that if the security lab could see the best new version of Pegasus operating live inside the phone, it increased the odds that Pegasus could see the security lab operating live inside the phone as well. Claudio and Danica had been anxious to wrap up this investigation as quickly as possible for weeks. Now they were really anxious to get it done. I had a great and growing appreciation for those concerns, especially after Amitai Ziv contacted me a few days later to say one of his sources in Israel, connected to the cyber industry there, asked him if we had a list. There were apparently rumors floating around Israel about a list connected to NSO. I asked Amitai to set up a call for me with his source. I suggested Amitai tell him we wanted his technical insights into the cyber exploit industry, as it was practiced in Israel. The guy seemed to be a bit of a gadfly around the cyber circuit in Israel when I did a little research on him. A self-described security expert who was always in attendance at the big cyber conferences where Prime Minister Netanyahu did his cheerleading for the industry. But he talked as if he was interested in policing cyber surveillance tools like Pegasus. So who knew? Maybe I was being paranoid. Maybe he would have something worthwhile to add. When I got him on the line, he said he wanted to be helpful to us, but the conversation very quickly got weird. The first strange thing he did was offer up a ludicrous math formula suggesting that the total number of people targeted by NSO clients added up to maybe 1.8 million over 10 years. A classic red herring. Then he started fishing for information. He never actually asked me about a list, but he did push for specifics about our investigation. "Sandrine, you haven't told me what this story is about," he said. "It's about cyber threats against journalists," I said, explaining as much as I could to somebody outside the consortium of reporters and editors. Like our Mexican story and our Moroccan story, basically. We're following what we started and really trying to find out what are the kinds of cyber threats that are possible against journalists and who can be targeted, and basically, technically, how this works. This wasn't good enough for him, he said. He wanted something more concrete, like maybe new signs he could check for us against his own database. I told him I'd send him a list of questions, which he could answer by email. Then I got off the line. He was persistent and not very subtle. "If you do have the database that was leaked, which is probably just a rumor," he wrote after we ended the call, "can you please look for my name there?" Now I found myself wondering if he was acting on behalf of NSO. A few days later, we heard from Shane Harris, one of a dozen or so reporters the Washington Post now had on the project. Shane had decided to scrub his planned trip to Israel. A new government had just taken charge a few weeks earlier. Netanyahu was out as prime minister, and Naftali Bennett was in. But it seemed very unlikely that the new administration would be any less protective of NSO Group. The Post thought that Israeli authorities knew something was heating up around the company and its technology, and Bennett's administration was worried about a big mess. The Post was starting to hear talk inside Israel of a Pegasus-related victim list. We were still 3 weeks away from publication, which seemed like a very long time to keep this investigation secret. And I wasn't entirely sure we would all get to safe harbor.